Welcome to America.
Right now, the American dream has turned into a nightmare.
We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
Welcome to America, the podcast that tells the true story of the United States, from the footsteps of the first colonists to the tragic fall of the Republic in the year 2024. Each week, we will read a chapter from the book by Rania Bint Mahdi, as translated from the Arabic, by me, Dylan Evans. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to take a moment to thank our lovely listeners. I'm really grateful to you for taking time to listen to Rania's version of US history. If you enjoy what you hear, there are a few ways you can support us and join the conversation. First off, make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. This way, you'll never miss an episode, and you'll always be the first to know when we drop new content. And we love hearing from you. Your reviews and feedback mean the world to us and help us improve the show. So take a quick moment to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're tuning in from. Tell us what you love, what you want more of, or even suggest topics that you'd like us to cover next. And hey, let's stay connected. Follow us on social media for behind-the-scenes content, sneak peeks of upcoming episodes, and maybe even some exclusive giveaways. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Real America. Right, that's all for now. Let's dive into today's episode. Thank you for being a part of the America tribe. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. America by Rania Bint Mahdi, translated from the Arabic by Dylan Evans. Chapter 2, A Conspiracy of Witches. The Puritans found in America not merely a wholesome refuge from the religious impurity of Inglaterra, but also a land crying out for Tawhid. For the savages that lived in this new world were polytheists and devil worshippers, and the Puritans immediately recognized their solemn duty to purge the land of shirk. Accordingly, they soon passed a law calling for the Christianizing of the Indians, as the savages were called, for reasons that are too fatuous to go into, and they sent out missionaries to preach the Injil among them. One particularly zealous missionary called John Eliot, or the Apostle to the Indians, established a number of praying towns, or praying villages, where Indians could live in a Christian community, learn the language of the Inglese, and adopt their customs. The first of these communities was Natick, in Massachusetts, and it became a model for future settlements. Each village had a church building where religious services were held, and there was also a school to teach Christian principles. The villages often had land for farming, and Eliot encouraged the Indians to adopt the agricultural practices of Inglaterra and learn civilized trades. The villagers were expected to attend daily prayer sessions and weekly religious services. Some Indians resisted this holy work and, determined to continue worshipping their idols, attacked the noble missionaries and those of their brethren who had rejected the evil traditions of their forefathers. One day, the body of a great Christian Indian called John Sassaman, who was a close associate of the great chief Metacom, was found beneath the ice of Assawompset Pond. It was clear that he had been murdered, and three Indian men were arrested, tried, and executed for the crime. Metacom, a proud and determined leader, whom the Inglese called King Philip, saw this as an act of aggression against his people. He rallied various tribes to his cause, seeking to drive the Inglese out of the land. The war was brutal and unforgiving. Indian warriors, who had been friends and neighbours, now became enemies of the Puritans, launching devastating attacks on their settlements. Villages were burned, crops destroyed, and many innocent lives lost. The siege of Puritan towns was a harrowing experience for the inhabitants, with constant fear gripping their hearts as they fought to defend their homes and families from the savages. Despite the hardships, they clung to their faith, praying fervently for Allah's protection and guidance. The turning point came with the Battle of Mount Hope, where Metacom's forces suffered a decisive defeat. Metacom himself was captured and executed. His death marked the end of the war, but the scars it left on the Puritan communities and on the Indian tribes would endure for generations. In the aftermath of the war, the Puritans continued their missionary work, but the once thriving, praying villages were now mere shadows of their former selves, their populations decimated by war and disease. Thousands of the settlers, nearly a tenth of the adult population, and perhaps twice that number of Indians, had been killed. The praying villages were reduced to nothing more than reservations of Indians struggling to maintain some vestige of tribal cohesion. The General Makama of Massachusetts ordered that no one in the colony was to buy or keep any Indian men or women above the age of 12, because they causeth much trouble and fear to the inhabitants where they reside, and could be a danger to the town. The warring Indians who survived were therefore shipped out to the Caribbean and the Mediterranean and sold into slavery. It seems that there was much hand-wringing among later historians about these and subsequent events in which the Indians came off rather worse than the settlers. They were filled with a mixture of grief for the lives lost, regret for the mistakes made, and a fervent hope for reconciliation and peace between them and the Indians who remained. They prayed that the mercy and grace of Allah might one day heal the wounds of those bitter conflicts and bring understanding and forgiveness to all involved. I cannot but see here, in these ignoble feelings, a symptom of the decline in the religious zeal of the Amerikiyun, which would eventually undermine their asabiyya and their sense of purpose. Another challenge faced by the settlers was that of ensuring that the legacy of Puritanism, with all its spiritual fervour and harsh intensity, would be passed down to their children and grandchildren. To this end, they soon realised that the process of moral and religious instruction would have to be institutionalised and not left to the whims of parents and pastors. Such was the motivation behind the establishment of the Harvard Madrasa, under the leadership of Nathaniel Eaton. Implicit within the madrasa's mission was the duty to foster orthodoxy within the next generation of imams, and its bylaws insisted that the Harvard Taliban eschew the profanation of God's holy name, attributes, word, and ordinances, and times of worship, and in the public assemblies they shall carefully eschew whatsoever may show any contempt or neglect thereof. The bylaws further stipulated that once a fortnight the president and fellows shall take care that heterodox opinions and doctrines be avoided and refuted, and such as are according to the faith be held forth and confirmed. Nathaniel Eaton did not, however, live up to expectations, for soon he marvellously deceived the expectations of good men concerning him. He was summoned by the General Makama and charged with embezzling funds from the madrasa, whipping his Taliban with between 20 and 30 stripes at a time, and beating one Talib in particular with a walnut tree plant big enough to have killed a horse and a yard in length. The Harvard Taliban also bitterly complained about the quality of the food prepared by Eaton's wife, who fed them mackerel with their guts in them and goat's dung in their hasty pudding. Ultimately, the magistrates convicted Eaton of sundry abuses and inhumane severities by him acted towards the scholars under his charge. And he was openly sentenced and removed from his trust. Eaton's shoes were soon filled by the Reverend Henry Dunster. But he seems to have been even more pernicious than his predecessor, for when he became a proud father, he shocked his colleagues by failing to present the infant for baptism. Among the heterogeneous mixture of religious sects that proliferated among the Amriccyon in those days, in which the vagaries of enthusiasm had their full scope, a group of fanatics had arisen who called themselves Mumadaniyun, for they forbade the baptism of infants and offered the sacrament only to adult converts. They had the temerity to deny the fundamental tenet of the Christian religion, namely that newborn babies are not just little devils, but literally devils, and must therefore be baptized immediately to wash away their diabolical nature and turn them into human beings. This sect claimed that it was necessary to consent to this rite of exorcism, and therefore that only adults could be baptized. It appears that Dunster had converted to this heretical creed, and he was consequently summoned before the Middlesex Mahkamah, where the Qadi solemnly admonished him of his dangerous error. But rather than submitting humbly to the hukum of the Qadi, Dunster impudently replied that it was the duty of every Christian to speak out against any practices that they believed to be corrupting the purity of the church, and so he was summarily dismissed in the same manner as his unruly predecessor. It would appear, then, that the madrasa at Harvard found it hard to strike the right balance between discipline and the open-mindedness that is so important in all education, and the teachers who laid the iron rod of excessive discipline upon the Taliban were excessively sparing of it where they themselves were concerned. Besides teaching the scriptures, the Harvard Madrasa was in those days also devoted to Renaissance and Reformation ideals. Its purpose was to give Christian gentlemen a liberal arts education and not merely to train the imams. Latin was the official language of college life. The Harvard Taliban were not to use the language of Inglaterra with each other unless called upon to do so in public exercises of oratory or the like. But not everyone was happy with this pagan influence. When the leading Puritan divine, Increase Mather, became president of the madrasa, one of his first acts was to replace the pagan classics in ethics classes with books by Christian authors. His son, Cotton Mather, also decried the emphasis on philosophy in the undergraduate curriculum, considering it to be a vile piece of paganism. Instead, he wanted Harvard to focus exclusively on Christian theology and the Puritan model for the path to salvation. Harvard responded by three times passing him over for the presidency. Stung by this rejection, Cotton Mather went on to procure both needed funding and a name for a new madrasa in Connecticut by appealing to a wealthy Inglese, Elihu Yale. Another famous talib to emerge from the Harvard Madrasa was Samuel Parris, the notorious minister of Salem Village. Born in Inglaterra to a family of modest means and religious nonconformity, Parris emigrated to Boston, where he attended the Harvard Madrasa, before leaving for Barbados, where he maintained a sugar plantation. After a hurricane damaged much of his property there, Parris returned to Boston with his slave, Tituba, and married a local beauty called Elizabeth. Together, they had three children, Thomas, Betty, and Susanna. But Paris was dissatisfied with his lack of financial security, and before long, he became minister of Salem Village. Salem Village was a contentious place to live and was known to be quarrelsome by neighbouring towns. Its dispersed settlement pattern may have resulted in a lack of the asabiya that united the more orderly and arranged communities. Tensions were exacerbated by King William's War, which brought new refugees and horror stories to the village. A serious drought also jeopardized food supplies. It was perhaps not surprising then when the newly arrived minister found himself facing considerable opposition from the local community. The initially favourable response to his ministerial style quickly evaporated, and the general dissatisfaction was reflected in the erratic payment of his salary. Eventually, the town decided to stop paying his wages altogether. The village was also rife with superstition, magic, and fortune-telling, which, as with so many other aspects of life in the colonies, had been brought over to America by the colonists from the mother country. The young girls of the village would, for example, drop the white of a raw egg into a glass and try to spy something about their future from the shape of the resulting blob. The stories about voodoo in the forest, however, and dark rumours about initiation rituals and satanic practices, drawing blood and dancing naked in the woods, are inventions of later historians. It appears that two of the girls in the Paris household, Betty, age 9, and Abigail Williams, her cousin, age 11, tried the egg experiment one day and thought that they saw the blob take on the form of a coffin. It was unsettling, possibly frightening, but hardly enough to spark the extraordinary physical symptoms that brought their activities to the attention of Paris and his wife. Betty began to exhibit bizarre bodily contortions and complained of pains throughout her body, pinching sensations and sharp, knife-like pains. Abigail soon followed suit, and then, a few weeks later, two more girls also began to complain of pain. One described sensations of a knife at her throat, and the other had visions of wolves trying to attack her. Diabolical influence was suspected, and only prayer could serve to exorcise the demons. The Reverend Paris thus initiated a series of prayers and made arrangements for a fast day for the community to repent of its collective sins. He knew of Cotton Mather's widely published success in exorcising the devils in four other children just a few years before, and employed the same rituals of prayer, calls for repentance, and tender loving care of the victims. But to no avail. 6 weeks later, poor Betty was still in pain. Finally, Mary Sibley, their neighbour, took the matter into her own hands and set out to determine who in the village had bewitched the little girls. In this enterprise, Sibley enlisted the aid of Tituba, the Paris family cook, and her husband, John Indian. Tituba agreed to prepare a witch cake under Sibley's supervision, a concoction of rye meal and the girl's urine, which was baked in ashes and fed to a dog. Supposedly, the dog was a familiar, that is, the animal form of a witch. The dog, bewitched by the cake, would then, according to their folklore, reveal the name of the witch who was causing the problem. Sibley appealed to Tituba and John because magic was so closely identified with Indians, which they both were. Unfortunately, their involvement in Mary Sibley's plan would set off a 10-month episode of intense fear, death, and emotional turmoil throughout Massachusetts. Far from being comforted by the witch cake, Betty and Abigail were frightened even more by this counter-magic practiced on their behalf, and they worried that they had inadvertently conspired to let an evil spirit loose in Salem. In the days following the witch cake incident, they developed even more violent and bizarre symptoms. They complained of torture by invisible hands. They began to see apparitions of murder victims. They were bitten and pinched by invisible agents. Their arms, necks and backs turned this way and that way and returned back again so it was impossible for them to do of themselves. And beyond the power of any epileptic fits or natural disease to effect. The Reverend Paris immediately suspected witchcraft. "The affliction," he wrote, "never break forth to any considerable light until diabolical means were used by the making of a cake by my Indian man, who had his directions from this our sister Mary Sibley, since which apparitions have been plenty. But by this means, it seems, the devil hath been raised amongst us." Betty and Abigail confirmed his suspicion and pointed the finger at Tituba. So Paris beat her until she confessed herself as a witch. More importantly, however, she implicated others and thereby aroused the fear that the awful symptoms exhibited by Betty and Abigail were not the work of a single witch acting alone, but were instead the work of a whole conspiracy of witches acting together. It was this idea that would make the resulting witch trials at Salem so different in scope and scale from all those that had gone before, leading to the arrest of over 150 people and the hanging of 19, before Governor William Phipps finally called a halt to the madness. Without Tituba's suggestion of a diabolical conspiracy, it might have been all over in a few days. So, why did Tituba make up this bizarre conspiracy theory? And why did the men who interrogated her fall for it? Perhaps it was her only way to stay alive. By fueling Puritan fantasies of a diabolical plot and implicating ever more victims, she had to be kept around as a witness. And coming from the mouth of an illiterate slave from Barbados, the impressive details of animal familiars and riding on broomsticks, many of which were scholastic rather than common folk knowledge, seemed clear proof to her interrogators that she could only have gleaned them from direct experience. These learned men simply could not credit the notion that an uneducated Indian woman might be a master storyteller capable of manipulating their fears in such a calculated fashion. But perhaps we should also attribute their gullibility to an inveterate fondness for conspiracy theories, a habit that would later become known as the paranoid style in the politics of America, and which would have such devastating consequences in the centuries to come. And that's a wrap for today's episode of Amrika. We hope you enjoyed diving into the real history of the United States with us. Before we sign off, I want to remind you to keep the conversation going. If you have thoughts, questions, or stories to share related to today's episode, we want to hear them. Drop us a line on social media or shoot us an email at dylan@amrikabook.com. And if you haven't already, don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. This way, you won't miss a single episode, and you'll always be up to date with the latest discussions and interviews. Also, your reviews mean the world to us. If you enjoyed today's episode or any others, please take a moment to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps us grow and improve. And of course, a big thank you to all of our amazing listeners. Your support keeps us motivated to bring you engaging and thought-provoking content every week. And that's it for now. Until next time, remember to stay curious, stay inspired, and keep fighting for justice. We'll catch you in the next episode of Amrika. Stay tuned.